The headlines: the Ukrainian president says Moscow is trying to wipe his country off the map after Russia strikes Kiev and several other cities. Tehran slams some Western countries for urging Iran to exercise restraint towards rioters. And Taiwan's president says a war with China is not an option, but warns that the island will never give up its democratic way of life.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Russia's military has struck the Ukrainian cities, including Kiev, with at least 75 missiles in the first such strikes in months. Officials say that the blast caused at least 5 deaths and 12 injuries in the capital, but there is little detail about the casualties and injuries in other attacks that hit western and central cities. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is now accusing Russia of trying to wipe his country off the face of the earth. He also says that Russia is targeting Ukrainian people and energy infrastructure in these attacks. The strikes come 2 days after a deadly blast destroyed a bridge between Russia and Crimea. The road was a key supply link for Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has blamed the Ukrainian Secret Service for the bridge attack. Leaders of the European Union pledge more military aid to Ukraine hours after missile strikes hit several parts of the country, including the capital, Kiev. Leaders of France and Germany are offering their full support in line with what they've called Kiev's military needs. Germany also says it will soon deliver an air defense system to Ukraine. Pledges of military aid are also coming in from Belgium and Italy, among other European countries. Meanwhile, the Group of Seven says it will meet on Tuesday to discuss the Russian missile strikes. Staying with Ukraine, our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, reports on the targeting of Western journalists who are critical of Ukraine and NATO, publishing stories from the Russian-held territory.
American journalist Wyatt Reed had only been in Donetsk an hour when this happened.
Just had an artillery strike here in Donetsk. Right outside my hotel.
Wyatt then sprints into his hotel. When the Ukrainians strike once, they often strike again.
We're here at the corner of Ottoman Street and Narova Ave, where a artillery strike by the Kiev regime just rocked this intersection. I was about 100 meters away at the time, and the devastation is incredible. This is a normal occurrence for the people of Donbass.
This was the second time the Donbass Palace, a hotel known to be frequented by journalists, has been hit. The windows are still boarded up from the previous blast. A local woman walking by was killed. And just down the street, Central Hotel, also previously known to house journalists, it was hit a few weeks ago. Reporters often congregated outside these doors. Not anymore.
It's terrifying. It's hard to describe the feeling of being subjected to an artillery attack. I panicked. I didn't really know what to do. I wanted, obviously, to look for safety, to find refuge, but I didn't want to go closer to the scene of the strike unless in case they decided to attack us again. I've never felt anything like that in my life. Feeling the ground shake, watching this massive fireball, having glass rain down around me, it's like nothing I've ever experienced.
Now, while most Western media outlets don't even send reporters to this side of the conflict, there are a few Western journalists who do come here. I've met many of them. They are good people, honest and courageous journalists who risk their lives, their reputations and their liberty simply for reporting the stories that they see around them. This is Eva Bartlett, an independent Canadian journalist. She's spent months reporting from Donbass and has faced smear attacks by Western media outlets for her unique and fearless on-the-ground reporting. She, like Wyatt Reed and myself, have been placed on the Ukrainian hit list Mitotravets, declared enemies of the Ukrainian state simply for reporting the truth in Donbass. Journalists who are killed are marked as liquidated on the site. While war rages across the country, Ukraine is also waging a propaganda war. Part of that campaign is the targeting of reporters who dare to report on stories that are critical of the Kiev regime. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Iran has accused the U.S. and some European governments of double standards on human rights by asking it to show restraint towards rioters.
Those who advise the Iranian government to avoid violence allow violent people to engage in acts of violence against Iranian embassies in their own countries, which enjoy diplomatic immunity according to the Vienna Convention.
Kanani also said those who lecture Iran on democracy and how to treat its citizens should not allow a knife-wielding man to attack an Iranian ambassador. This was a reference to the recent assault on the Iranian embassy in the Danish capital, Copenhagen. Iranian missions have been attacked in several European countries, including the UK and Norway, over the past weeks. Kanani added that Iran has no problems with protests and believes in dialogue, but he said protesting is different from a rioting, and Iran does not tolerate actions that undermine public security. Kanani said Western countries should stop this hypocritical behavior and fulfill their legal obligations to protect Iran's diplomatic missions. Iran has hosted transport ministers from five Central Asian countries for talks on new transit policies aimed at boosting cooperation among the participating states. Yusuf Jaloudi reports.
A new transit map is being charted here. Transport ministers from Iran and five Central Asian countries, including Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan, are in Tehran, attending the first transit cooperation summit.
This summit is held on the initiative of the Islamic Republic. Regarding the political atmosphere of our region, transit is of major significance. More efficient transport policies are decisive for the development of countries, especially when it comes to import and export.
Our colleagues will work within the next 2 weeks to draw up a joint document that will lay out the roadmap for improving and increasing the level of our country's transit cooperation.
To facilitate border traffic, the participating countries agreed to digitalize transit processes, facilitate embassy affairs and visa issuance, especially for transit drivers, and improve tariffs and transit charges. More countries, including Russia and Azerbaijan, are also set to join the initiative. Iran is situated on a geopolitically important region, connecting the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf in its south to the Caspian Sea in its north. The country is already party to the International North-South Transport Corridor, which is a 7,200-kilometer-long multimode network of ship for moving freight between India, Iran, Azerbaijan, Russia, Central Asia, and Europe.
This is an all-win step for all sides of the bargain here, because the landlocked Central Asian states will no longer have to worry about accessing the global transit network. And by doing this, Iran will turn into a transit hub in the region, pushing its annual transport volume to over 20 million tons. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Earlier today, Taiwan said it is willing to talk to China if it respects the island's sovereignty. Beijing has reacted to that, saying separatist tendencies in the island are the root cause of the current problems. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen. China has a shot back at Taiwan after its president said a constructive interaction with Beijing is possible if Beijing respects the island's sovereignty. Chinese foreign minister says that the root cause of problems in Taiwan is the territory is seeking independence from the mainland in China. The ministry says that Beijing will never let the separatists in Taiwan to achieve territorial independence. Early on Monday, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen accused China of threatening peace and stability in the region. Tsai says that the island wants no war with Beijing but will continue to boost its defense capabilities. China has recently increased its military activities near the island. Beijing says it is ready to use force to make sure that Taiwan remains part of its territory. To discuss that further, we're joined by Ken Doshu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution of Beijing. And also we have with us Zamir Ahmed Awan, a non-resident fellow at the Center for China and Globalization in Islamabad. Let's begin with Mr. Xu. Now, what do you make of these comments by the president of Taiwan? It seems that Taiwan is, in a way, backing off from its previous stance where they kept defying China, and in defiance of Beijing, they actually had over a number of U.S. officials visiting them.
Well, let me emphasize one point. You know, in her speech, Tsai Ing-wen mentioned about requiring Beijing to respect sovereignty of Taiwan. This is the issue. You know, if you this is a fake attempt to seek a consolation with Beijing, because Taiwan is never sovereign. It's part of China, and to check their country's foreign policy toward China, for example, there's a one China principle. Taiwan is part of China. Only a few, like less than seven, about seven countries that have a full diplomatic relationship with Taiwan. The rest of the world, basically almost all countries around the world, recognize that there is a one China, Taiwan is part of China. Unless she recognize and respect this reality, it is very difficult to see there is a true consolation, you know, from the Taiwan side. And secondly, if you talk to people in Taiwan, in particular the older generation, they would always view themselves as Chinese. Taiwan is part of China, just like the mainland is part of China. So there's a strong tradition for the Chinese people to pursue reunification if there's a problem with our territory. And then, as I mentioned earlier, around the world, even the U.S., which supports the independence of Taiwan, they recognize there's one China, that, you know, Taiwan is part of China. So no. And if she sincerely pursues peace and stability, she needs to talk to Beijing on the basis of the reality, that is, Taiwan is part of China.
So, Mr. Ahmed, in your opinion, do you expect Taiwan, considering what the president said today, to try to expand its relations further with the U.S., or will they stop where they are right now?
First of all, I will appreciate the move by the Taiwanese president. They have shown some flexibility, or they have shown the interest to communicate with mainland China. This is something positive development, and we must appreciate. As a matter of fact, China was pursuing Taiwan for a long, long time to come to the negotiating table, to come to the dialogue, and reunification process should be started much, much earlier. China has shown a lot of flexibility toward Taiwan. Even that, the great leader of China, Mr. Deng Xiaoping, he has innovative idea, one country with the two system. That's how they have managed Hong Kong and Macau. It is the one country, but with the two system, with the highest degree of autonomy to Hong Kong and Macau. Even that, the Chinese government has consented that if Taiwan want to negotiate, they might give them more concessions, more discounts, or more flexibility, or highest degree of the autonomy, but it should be reunified. It should be reunited. Till latest days, Taiwan was refusing, and also some of the influence of the Western countries like USA was pursuing Taiwan to keep its independence, or its sovereignty, or its sole proprietorship, and they were extending the military aid, and they were having political support. Even that recently, Nancy Pelosi has visited Taiwan. These were the things which the China was much annoyed. The recent statement by the Taiwanese president is really very much appreciated, and I term it the first step toward the right direction. A lot have to be done furthermore, but it is at least the good beginning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zamir Ahmad Awan, non-resident fellow at the Center for China and Globalization in Islamabad, and also Mr. Kenduo Xu, senior fellow at the Pangol Institute in Beijing. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has vowed to strengthen the country's military operations going forward. Kim also rejected any dialogue with Pyongyang's adversaries. He made the comments while overseeing the country's tactical nuclear military training that concluded just days ago. North Korea fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile that passed through Japan's airspace, sparking harsh reactions from Tokyo, Seoul, and Washington. It was reportedly a newly developed missile aimed at delivering stronger and clearer warning to Pyongyang's enemies. The country has launched 7 missiles in the last 2 weeks. The North says its missile launches are necessary countermeasures as it considers joint war games by the U.S., Japan, and South Korea a rehearsal for invasion. People in Pakistan are joining fellow Muslims in other countries to celebrate the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. The occasion was marked by a host of events, including processions in the capital, Islamabad. Nasser Kazmi reports.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonating in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets, and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
U.S. President Joe Biden has assigned a classified new policy limiting counterterrorism drone strikes, tightening rules that his predecessor Donald Trump had loosened. But people in Afghanistan, a major victim of U.S. drone operations in recent years, remain concerned that they might be still the target of American unmanned aircraft flying over their country. Abdullah Amirzadeh has more.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed a new classified policy that limits the country's drone operations and tightens the rules of engagement. This policy will limit drone operations in several countries where the U.S. has carried out many strikes in recent years, including Afghanistan. U.S. drones, however, are still flying in the skies of Afghanistan, and people are worried that deadly strikes could still happen any moment. Back in 2017, the Trump administration replaced old guidelines with a looser set of rules for drone engagement that led to a 330% rise in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A research by an independent media organization shows that from 2015 to 2020 alone, between 300 to 900 civilians lost their lives to U.S. drone operations. Experts say that even with the new policy adopted, U.S. drones in Afghanistan are still dangerous. The aforementioned policy requires near certainty that a target is a member of a designated terrorist group and near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured before pulling the trigger. But it still remains unclear what this near certainty standard means in practice. The precision of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan has always been under question. There have been many examples of misguided U.S. strikes, notably an attack just before the withdrawal of U.S. forces last year that killed 10 members of a family. People here are still concerned that they might be the next target. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Be wary of Allah and settle your differences. The third is something universal that applies to whatever it is you are doing. And it means to do whatever is good and avoid whatever is bad. Obey Allah and His Apostle by following their commands. Should you be faithful, then you will do all of this. The issue of faith, this pledge of the heart, this bond of thought, belief and mind to a single issue, to a single person, to a single pole, to a single core, this thing we call faith cannot come about simply by these means, simply by a person feeling an attachment in their heart. No, the time when faith truly inheres in a person, when it becomes actualized, is when that person acts on it. Then, and only then, can a person claim that they are truly faithful, when they fulfill the requirements of faith and they act in accordance with faith. Then they can say they are truly faithful, that they truly believe, because it is only then that their life and the very fabric of their being differs from someone who denies Allah and rejects the truth.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, what is the difference in behavior between someone who denies Allah and someone who claims to believe in Him? They both do wrong. They are both absorbed by the materialistic concerns until their last breath. They are both willing to trade all virtue and all goodness for two more morrows, for two more morsels, for two more breaths. The only difference is that one honestly says, I don't believe in God. The other claims that he believes in God. What kind of faith is this? The Quran is clear about what faith means. This is not some philosophical argument about which there can be doubt. If you truly believe, do these things. And one of these things is that you obey Allah and obey the Apostle, that you do as they command. What is God's command? It is self-evident that every person has certain duties and responsibilities, whether this is with regards to their own property, life and soul, or whether it is with regard to their relationship with other human beings, their relationship with Allah, their relationship with animals, or even their relationship with plants. If you obey Allah in all of these different fields of your life, then you can say you are a true believer. Otherwise, faith merely in the sense of feeling an attachment to some principle or cause, but without this attachment being reflected in one's words or deeds, in one's limbs or behavior, is of no use.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the U.S. Congress has passed another aid for Kyiv, which amounts to some $12 billion. And this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the U.S. has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization, The Intercept, stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel. According to the report, before the Russian special military operation, the CIA believed Ukraine would fall quickly and so withdrew most of its forces and assets. But later on, as the war lengthened, the CIA began to believe that that wouldn't happen, and Washington sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. But all this back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and the West's unilateral support for Kyiv has given rise to a new crisis, one which doesn't only involve the two warring sides anymore, and that is nuclear warfare. On Thursday, at a fundraiser in New York, U.S. President Joe Biden made an extraordinary and, as some say, highly alarming comments about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war and the threat of a nuclear war. Biden said the risk of nuclear Armageddon is at its highest point since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. But the question which comes to mind is whether this admission is a result of the Biden administration's policy of supporting Ukraine in a war on Russia's border or Moscow's actions so far. Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out about using nuclear weapons, but never directly stated that he will use them. During his speech, however, Biden stated that Putin is not joking when he talks about the use of tactical nuclear weapons. The last time the US was faced with such a situation was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which then President John F. Kennedy resolved through negotiations and striking a deal with Cuba. Biden, however, has so far shown no signs of walking back on its policies regarding Ukraine, and this has been clear in the US not showing any interest in diplomacy and virtually cutting off all high-level talks. Not only this, Biden has time and again reiterated his support for Kiev, and the billions of dollars of aid is only a demonstration of the fact. Following the West's unconditional and unilateral support, Kiev has also pushed matters a step further and is now calling for strikes on Russia. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for NATO to launch what he called a preventive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. But this has raised questions about Kiev's ambitions and the chances that the move would spark World War III and possibly a nuclear war. The Kremlin also responded to the comment and said Zelensky was trying to spark a world war. The remark gave birth to internal disputes in Kiev, with Ukrainian officials downplaying what Zelensky said. Now, as the world is faced with several economic, social, and environmental challenges, the warmongering aspirations of the US and its allies seem to have pushed humanity to the point of no return. But many, including Washington and Kiev, seem to be more focused on pushing their own agenda forwards, regardless of what's at stake.
As the crisis in Ukraine is getting worse, chances for a diplomatic solution to the war are looking slim. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a decree that formally declares the prospect of any Ukrainian talks with Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin, quote, impossible. The decree also approves the decision of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council to strengthen Ukrainian defense. The decree came after Russia annexed four regions of Ukraine into its own territory. President Putin has just signed into law four unification treaties with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as the Kherson and Zaporozhye region. Russia says Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics split from Ukraine in 2014 following what Kremlin describes as the Maidan coup. Russia's decision to incorporate the regions into its own territory comes amid reports of Ukraine's military advances. According to President Zelensky, Ukrainian forces have retaken dozens of villages from Russia in the east and the south of the country. However, the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had already left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region.
Тільки за цю добу на Херсонщині від псевдореферендуму було звільнено і стабілізовано такі населені пункти, як Нововоскресенське, Новогригорівка і Петропавлівка. Рух продовжує.
Ukraine is now trying to make further inroads in the south and east before the colder weather arrives. Russia is trying to deploy the 300,000 reservists called up in a partial mobilization 2 weeks ago. But that would take some time before it can be operational. The developments come as the US is sending more weapons into Ukraine.
This morning, President Biden spoke with President Zelensky to underscore that the United States will never recognize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory and will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. President Biden informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing a new $625 million security assistance package to Ukraine as they continue to defend their country from Russia's invasion.
The new $625 million military package approved by the Biden administration includes additional weapons and equipment, including HIMARS, artillery systems and ammunition, and armored vehicles. The United States has now sent Ukraine more than $16.8 billion in military hardware, Russia has now warned that the shipment of new military hardware to Ukraine will risk direct confrontation with the United States. The supply of military products by the US and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries. Concerns are now rising over a possible nuclear confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has already warned that his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. The war in Ukraine has already caused a crisis for the European Union. Energy prices have soared and the rising cost of living is putting many Europeans into poverty.
We have now to limit this inflationary impact of gas on electricity and everywhere in Europe. This is why we are ready to discuss a cap on the price of gas that is used to generate electricity. This cap would also be a first step on the way to a structural reform, an overall reform of our electricity market.
There are now signs that the support for Ukraine amongst Europeans is dropping. A survey by YouPinion's pollster has revealed that 60% of EU's population were on board with sending weapons to Kiev. The number was 64% back in March. It now appears that the lingering crisis in Ukraine could lead to social unrest across the continent. European leaders are concerned over the rise of far-right groups which could potentially create cracks within the anti-Moscow coalition in Brussels.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence, and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, the truce has ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In a statement, the Ansarullah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed, beyond any doubt, its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war. UN has expressed its disappointment with the failure to extend Yemen's truce, saying negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. But what will happen if the fighting resumes? The ceasefire has brought a sharp drop in fighting in the war, but now millions will once again be at risk of air strikes, ground shelling, and missile attacks. Also, with the ceasefire in place, the daily lives of the Yemeni people dramatically improved. Fuel imports into the port of Hodeidah have quadrupled, while more essential goods entered the blockaded country and prices came down. In addition, the international charity Save the Children said the truce had led to a 60% decrease in displacement and a 34% drop in child casualties in Yemen. The Saudi-led military campaign had caused the internal displacement of 4.3 million Yemenis by March 2022. Humanitarian organizations have called on both sides to extend the arm of diplomacy, pointing out that 8 to 23 million people out of a total population of 30 million will be severely affected. So, if the humanitarian and military armistice is not renewed, everything will go back to square one. The risk of a large-scale famine, violence, collapsing services, and protracted displacement are the biggest challenges in Yemen now. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has severely censured the unrest that erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, stating that the deadly riots were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comment in an address to military cadets in Tehran, saying he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots. Protests over the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fainted at a police station and was later pronounced dead at a hospital, erupted first in her native province of Kurdistan and later spread to other parts of the country, including Tehran. The leader said reactions to the incident were not normal. The riots were not natural, as groups of people caused social disturbances on the streets, burned copies of the Holy Quran, harassed veiled women, and set mosques, religious congregational halls, and private cars on fire. According to a statement released by the Iranian Intelligence Ministry, the rioters have been backed by Western regimes and their mercenary media, who disseminated misinformation and distorted the sequence of events that led to Amini's death, even before the official investigation into the incident concludes. Also, the intelligence ministry said 9 people from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries have been arrested for their role in the riots. From the very beginning, different Western media began a campaign against Iran, voicing support for the rioters. That's why they have remained silent for years about the strict sanctions imposed on Iran. Meanwhile, a teenage girl named Zainab Essa Majid al-Khazali was killed during American military drills near a U.S. military camp close to the international airport in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. There was an effective blackout on the death in Western media. So why are they refusing to show the same sensibility about Zainab's death? Seemingly, what matters most is creating turmoil in the stable nations in West Asia. Shortly after the death of Mahsa Amini, allegations of mistreatment and even torture surfaced in social media platforms, and Western media outlets lost no time in picking up the story and willfully distorting it. Before any official statement was made, Iran was accused of deliberate killing, and Mahsa was brutally killed by Iranian police was the talk of the town. Unsurprisingly, these headlines come as part of a systematic campaign to attack Iran and cause turmoil in the country.
There have been more anti-government protests in the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Just a moment ago, protests spreading in the country of Iran over the death of a young woman earlier this month.
The protests in Iran.
In addition, for years, the West, particularly the United States, has been trying to stop Iran's progress by using economic sanctions, military threats, cyber attacks, and assassinations. In his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. and its allies' main problem is a strong and independent Iran and the country's progress. He pointed to the country's progress in all sectors, efforts aimed at facilitating domestic production, activation of knowledge-based companies, and the country's ability to neutralize Western sanctions.
The leader said that enemies are gravely mistaken in their calculations, and their plots will not yield anything at all. And he's right. Iranians once again foiled the enemy's plots after huge crowds of people took to the streets across Iran to denounce acts of vandalism and desecration of Islamic sanctities by rioters, sending a strong message that Iran's security and stability is the most important issue.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. My explanation does not dwell on the transcendental, spiritual, or mystical aspects of Theghalane. It is a domain, the cognition of which covers all circles of being from earth to heaven and beyond to his divine presence, including circles that lie beyond our comprehension.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world. You're listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio, and this is your humble host, Zainab Mousavi. In this program, we will discuss and elaborate on Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi's viewpoints in regards to the station of the mother. In one of his speeches, he holds that no occupation is more honorable than motherhood. And again, in another speech, he says and emphasizes the great station of mother, with this sentence, you ladies enjoy the honor of motherhood and you exceed men in such honor. Imam Khomeini's views are just in accordance to Islam and Quran's teaching, and he descends motherhood so noble and so respectable that he believes that through such an honor, women can exceed men. You know, motherhood is sacred because not only a mother brings her child to this world, but also provides the set and foundation for him or her to build in the future. And the love of the mother is so unconditional and undeserved that for a mother, it does not matter whether her child is a sick or healthy one, bad or good one, weak or strong one, and even young or old one. So let's have a short break and then I will explain it more. Okay, welcome back. We were talking about one of the speeches of the great founder of Iranian revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. I was saying that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh's view about the love and sacrifice of the mothers is so precise, and he sets a great difference and even considers women to be supreme over men due to their ability of being a mother. We all have heard about the famous quote from Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi that paradise lies beneath the feet of mothers. And this hadith, just like Imam Khomeini's precious words, signifies the greatness and honor of motherhood. Even in Quran, we have the 15th verse of Surah Al-Ahqaf about this issue. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that his mother has carried him in pain and bore him in pain, and his gestation and weaning takes 30 months. All these views represent the great position of a mother, so do not forget to respect your mothers if they are alive and in case they have passed away. I ask God's mercy and blessings to be with them. Thank you for listening to us. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the move by the Hindu nationalist government in India to outlaw a Muslim political outfit and its affiliates over terror charges. And we shall also look at the relentless Daesh terrorist attacks on the Hazara Shia community in Afghanistan and growing calls for security, justice, and accountability.
The Hindu nationalist government in India has just recently outlawed a Muslim political outfit and its affiliate organizations, accusing them of involvement in criminal and terror cases. It came after multiple raids and arrests of over 250 members of the outfit in several Indian states. The vicious crackdown on the members and supporters of the Popular Front of India, followed by the ban, has been described as a witch hunt by Muslim activists in the country. It comes amid growing religious polarization under the BJP government.
The Popular Front of India, a lesser-known political outfit that claims to represent Muslims in India, and its affiliate organizations were on September 27 declared unlawful under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act by the Narendra Modi government. An order issued by India's Home Ministry accused them of raising funds in India and abroad as part of a well-crafted criminal conspiracy. The ministry said the PFI and its affiliates were engaged in activities prejudicial to the integrity, sovereignty, and security of the country. Besides the PFI itself, organizations linked to it, including Rehab India Foundation, Campus Front of India, All India Imams Council, National Confederation of Human Rights Organization, National Women's Front, Junior Front, Empower India Foundation, and Rehab Foundation have also been banned. The Campus Front of India, the PFI student wing, denounced the ban as undemocratic and unconstitutional, vowing to challenge it in the apex court. The ban came days after at least 250 PFI leaders and workers across 15 Indian states were arrested.
The banning of the Popular Front of India has been in the air for quite a while. It never really impacted a large part of the country, and it was confined to the southern states, largely Kerala and Karnataka, for instance. There have been allegations against them for violence and for acts of terror, but it wasn't such a big thing. So if have they been arrested or banned primarily because of witch hunt, I'm not really sure. But I think what the government has been trying to, what the nationalist party has been trying to do is to show up these outfits as terror outfits, and largely to show that a section of the minority is synonymous with terror. That is a grander plan, and that is where PFI really fits in.
The PFI, created in 2007 through the merger of three Muslim organizations in southern India, describes itself as an outfit that works towards the achievement of socio-economic, cultural, and political empowerment of the deprived and the downtrodden and the nation at large.
Radical Hindu groups allied with India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party had long demanded a ban on the Popular Front of India. It comes as minority Muslims in the country have in recent years complained of marginalization under the Hindu nationalist federal government. The ban on the Muslim outfit and arrests of its leaders has evoked a mixed response, with